The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, my talk was inspired by a question last week at the topic I was talking about last week was or part of the topic I was talking about was at one point that there are times when we begin to move towards some states of ease or peace or calm in our meditation, and then we can start to want those, and that there can be a kind of a clinging or craving around that. And so the question at the end of the talk was, well, how do we practice without wanting to be happy? And so I thought I would talk about that question today. And to start, though, I'll back up. I'm going to start by talking about the topic of dukkha, which is the Pali term for what's usually translated as suffering. But there's different ways. Well, first of all, I want to say I love talking about dukkha. I love talking about this topic because in this context, the teaching of the Buddha, you know, is really very much oriented around this question of suffering, this question of dukkha. One of the most central teachings in Buddhism is the Four Noble Truths, which is framed around this question of suffering. It's famously stated, the first noble truth, there is suffering. The second noble truth, there's a cause to this suffering. The third noble truth, there's a possibility to end this cause, which will end the suffering. And the fourth noble truth, that there's a way, things that we can do, set of actions we can take to end the suffering, to eliminate the cause of suffering. And so the framing of the teachings are around suffering, and yet it's not just that it's like, oh, everything's suffering. That the really what I think that the Four Noble Truths are saying is possible to have some freedom, some ease, some peace in our lives, even in the midst of how challenging things are in the world. And so that's why I love talking about dukkha, because there's been so much, at least in my experience and engagement with this practice, so much letting go around how my own mind participates in this question of suffering. And so that's why I like talking about it so much, because I've seen so much benefit from this exploration, not only talking about it, but also beginning to practice in the way that the teachings suggest. So one thing I'll say to start is that this term dukkha, this Pali term dukkha, used to translate suffering, is used in different ways in the texts. And sometimes that can lead to some confusion. And so I'll start by just talking about that. There are three different ways that this term is used in the texts. The first way is that it relates to unpleasant experience, pain, for example. So there's an understanding that all of our experience has a quality. You know, whenever we have some sense contact, whenever there's a sight, a sound, a smell, a taste, a touch, or something happening in our minds, it's going to be either pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And so that pleasant, unpleasant quality of our experience, the unpleasant, the word for unpleasant there is dukkha. So it sometimes refers to just the simple aspect of unpleasantness of experience. Now, when the teaching says that we can be free of dukkha, it doesn't mean that we can be free of unpleasant experience. And so this is not the kind of dukkha that the Buddha said would end. In fact, in one teaching, one sutta that, you know, it, one teaching the Buddha gave, he said, you know, there a person who's fully awake, so a person who's fully awake in this very life will experience pleasant and unpleasant and neutral feeling. And an ordinary person will experience pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feeling. And so he clearly says that the process of waking up, the process of freedom, doesn't mean that we're going to stop feeling this unpleasant sensation. You know, we stub our toes, there's unpleasantness in the body. We cut ourselves with a knife, there's unpleasantness in the body. That doesn't go away. So there is some measure of unpleasant experience that is just a fact of life. There's some measure of pleasant experience that is just a fact of life. So that's the first way that dukkha is used, this unpleasantness of experience. A second way it's used is it's used to describe what is the term is sometimes called, it's used to describe a characteristic of experience, in that, you know, experience, whatever we're experiencing will come and go. There's no experience that we have that lasts. Now, there's nothing that's permanent. We cannot find something that we can hold on to that will forever make us happy. So there's there's nothing out there that is permanent and reliable. Nothing in our experience that is permanent. And the corollary to that is that because there's nothing that's permanent, there's nothing out there that's going to be a reliable source of happiness for us. No experience, no thing we can get, no state of mind that we have, no relationship, no anything, no place of status, nothing that we typically go for in terms of trying to find our happiness is going to be permanent and reliable. And so that word, that experience basically is unreliable as a place for lasting happiness, that word unreliable also is dukkha. So from that standpoint, sometimes it's said all experience is dukkha. That's what that's referring to. There's nothing out there that is reliable as a place to be happy. It doesn't mean that all experience is unpleasant. But even our pleasant experience is not a place where we can say, oh, that's it, I've figured it out, I've got it now, I'm going to be happy forever. And so that's the unreliability. And so that's another word that is talked about is dukkha. These first two kinds of dukkha, the dukkha of unpleasant experience and the dukkha of unreliability, these are facts of life. They don't go away. The Buddha was subject to this kind of impermanent, unreliable experience. The Buddha was subject to pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. So this is just a fact of life. The third kind of dukkha is what I think of or I understand as the dukkha of the first noble truth. The third kind of dukkha relates to this kind of, basically what I see as the reactivity to the first two kinds of dukkha, to the unpleasant nature of experience, to the unreliable nature of experience. We don't like it. You know, it's also very natural that we don't like it. But that reactivity, that basically that sense of, I've got to figure out, it must be some problem with me that I can't figure out how to make all my experience happy and to have reliable happiness. It must be my fault. Or it must be somebody else's fault. There must be somebody out there I can blame about this, that I'm not happy all the time. And so this the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, the dukkha that the Buddha says is possible to release, is a reactivity to these first two kinds of dukkha. And in that story that I mentioned about the Buddha saying that people who are fully awakened, people who are free from what I'll call this third kind of dukkha, the dukkha of the First Noble Truth, people who are free from that kind of dukkha experience unpleasant experience, experience pleasant experience, experience neutral experience. And ordinary people experience pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience. And so he says, what's the difference between them? If there's a flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience in somebody who's awake, and a flow of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience in somebody who's ordinary, who's confused, what's the difference between them? He says, an ordinary person, when they experience unpleasant experience, they feel put upon, they feel reactive, they feel, why me? So that there's, when an ordinary person experiences unpleasantness, they tend to respond with aversion. Don't like it, want to get rid of it. And that aversion is a form of reactivity. When an ordinary person experiences pleasant experience, they want to hold on to it. They want to try to keep it in the face of its impermanence. They're trying to hold on to something that's slipping through their grasp. One teacher described a student of his as that, describing that kind of trying to hold on to something pleasant, some impermanent experience as pleasant, as rope burn. Because you're trying to hold on to something that's just slipping through your fingers. And so even that kind of relationship, so when there's something pleasant, we want to hold on to it, even that creates suffering, creates reactivity. The Buddha said that in that, you know, it's like there's an unpleasant experience that comes. And with an ordinary person, he said it's like there's that unpleasant experience, and that's like a dart. We feel the pain of that dart. And an ordinary person then picks up another dart and stabs themselves with it. The reactivity, the aversion, is another dart. That second dart, he says, is optional. His description of a person who is free in this life is that when they experience an unpleasant feeling, they experience an unpleasant feeling. When they experience a pleasant feeling, they experience a pleasant feeling. It is not followed by either some sense of, this is a problem, I have to get rid of this, I have to fix this, I have to push it away, that reactivity, that clinging, or holding on and being subject to rope burn. So the Buddha points to the dukkha of the First Noble Truth being our reaction to unpleasant, pleasant experience, even neutral experience, our reaction to impermanent, unreliable experience. And so this reactivity, the reactivity is really what is what the Buddha says can be released. We are going to be in a field of impermanent, unreliable experience. We're going to be a field of changing, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. That's not going to change. But we can explore this reactivity. And this is really pointing to the Second Noble Truth, because that reactivity is born in our own minds. You know, we think in some ways that, you know, something happens out there, some unpleasant thing, we cut ourselves with a knife, and then we get angry, or we get frustrated or confused, and we think, who wouldn't get angry or frustrated or confused when they cut themselves with a knife? Or who wouldn't get get angry or frustrated when they fall down and bruise their knee or break their leg. You know, who wouldn't? But what the Buddha points to is that reactivity is optional. It's not necessary. And that reactivity is the arising of this kind of suffering. It's extra. It's the second dart, or third, or fourth, or fifth, because we often will react to reactivity. We get frustrated, and then we get angry that we're frustrated, or we're confused, and we're mad that we're confused, or we want something, and we're fearful that it will go away. So there's layers of reactivity that happen. And so the second noble truth is that the source of suffering, the source of this kind of suffering, is the reactivity itself. The term that the Buddha uses is craving, tanha. And that craving incorporates or includes both the wanting to hold on to things and wanting to get rid of things. It's basically a craving to, in some ways, to stop the flow of impermanence, to find a way to construct my environment so that it's just the way I want it right now and then hold it there. That's what that craving is. And it's not going to work. So we suffer. So that kind of suffering, that's what the Buddha points to as what we can possibly be free from. So I think it's important to name that, you know, that this is the kind of suffering we can be free from. So I think often this kind of reactivity is related to the pleasant, unpleasant quality of experience. Something's pleasant, we like it, we want it. Something's unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. This kind of reactivity is also a result of what I sometimes say, not being aligned with what is true. You know, that when we want to find a way to construct our environment so it's just the way we like it and hold it there, we're not aligned with the truth of impermanence. We're not aligned with the truth of unreliability. We are trying to go against the nature of things by trying to hold on to it. So this wanting, this craving, is the cause of this kind of dukkha. And this wanting is something that's happening in our own minds. You know, as I said a minute ago, it's like, who wouldn't respond or react? And yet there is the possibility, and this is what we start to see as we begin to explore our experience, we begin to see the possibility of relating to experience in a different way. That when we turn with mindfulness to pleasant experience, we begin to see, oh, there's pleasant experience happening. And we start to see the kind of automatic tendency or conditioned nature of the mind that wants to go out and hold on to it. And we actually start to see that holding on already feels painful. This is a kind of an awakening or insight as we start to turn to our experience and look at it. We see that wanting something, wanting to hold on to something, already feels painful. Now, this is not something that's obvious, actually, I think, because, you know, we're so focused outward. If something's pleasant, we're focused outward on the thing we want to have, to hold on to. If something's unpleasant, we're focused outward on trying to figure out how to get rid of it. And in that being focused outward, we are not paying attention to how we are inwardly around the wanting or the aversion. It's like our mind misses that entirely because it's so focused on the idea of, if I get that thing, I'll be happy. If I get rid of that thing, I'll be happy. And that idea of being in control, of being able to control my life and to create just the perfect scenario, that idea feels somewhat good, that I can control this. And because of that idea in our minds, we're missing the fact that in this very moment, the wanting or the aversion already hurts. And so our minds confuse us. Our minds delude us into thinking, I'll be happy in the next, you know, maybe next week or next month or maybe, you know, 3 minutes from now when I get that thing that I want, or I'll be happy when I finally create the conditions to get rid of that thing. And so essentially what our minds are willing to do in this whole process of how we usually navigate the world is give up happiness and ease and relaxation here and now for some possibility of a few moments of having something that we want or getting rid of something that we don't want. So the as we turn with mindfulness and begin looking at, instead of focusing outward on, oh, there's that thing, that pleasant thing, I like it, let me figure out how to get it. So instead of focusing on that, or instead of focusing on the unpleasant thing and how we might get rid of it, or convince, you know, the unpleasant thing might be a person who disagrees with us, you know, that how do we convince them to agree with us? You know, if instead of being focused outwardly, we turn and recognize, what does it feel like to want? What does it feel like to have aversion? And right there, we experience the unpleasantness of that. Now, why would that be useful? Because what we see is that what we start to see as we turn to this, as we explore the kind of familiar movement, familiar but not hardwired, let's say, familiar movement from something that is pleasant to liking, to wanting, to grasping, from something that is unpleasant to not liking, to wanting to get rid of, to aversion. There's a kind of a range of reactions to pleasant and unpleasant. As we turn and look at the process, we see that it is our minds that cling. It is our minds that push away. It's not automatic. It feels sometimes like it's very, well, it is very conditioned. From the time that we were born, and maybe even previous lives, you know, from the time that we were born, we have been conditioned to get what we want, to get rid of what we don't want. And there is a form of happiness that comes from that. There is. There absolutely is. When we get something we want, it feels good. There's a moment of feeling good there. Not only because we have what we want, but because the unpleasantness of wanting has gone away. When we get rid of something that we don't want, there's the happiness of no longer being in association with what's unpleasant, and there's the happiness of the aversion going away because it's no longer there. So there is that feeling good when we navigate through life this way. And, you know, that's the only way that we've ever, you know, from the time that we're born, that's how we've learned to find even these little moments of happiness. That's it. It's like we think that's the best it gets. That's as good as it gets, to get those little moments of happiness. And maybe we think if we can string enough of those little moments of happiness together, that's what happiness would be. So this idea that getting what I want makes me happy, and that's as good as it gets, that's a form of confusion. And right in there, in the beginning to watch our experience, if you can, and this is something I recommend for some perhaps small kind of wanting or small kind of aversion, if you can begin to watch the thing that you want and watch the wanting about it, and not act on the wanting, but just watch the wanting. Just watch it. Or something you don't want. Rather than taking the action to get rid of it, just Watch the aversion. See what happens. At some point, because not only are the pleasant and unpleasant things impermanent, but the states of mind are impermanent, at some point that wanting or that aversion will go away. And you will experience the release from the wanting or the release from the aversion without ever having had the thing or gotten rid of the thing consciously yourself. Now, sometimes this happens, like for instance, one example. I was sitting at a corner at a stoplight, and across the street there was a Starbucks. And my mind created the image of a latte in my mind, and it's like pleasant, you know, that the mind created, because of the Starbucks, right? Because the Starbucks was sitting there, the image of the latte arose in my mind, and the idea of the pleasantness of having that latte. Now, it wasn't the pleasantness of the latte itself, it was an idea. It was a pleasantness of an idea there. And there was that wanting for, to fulfill the pleasantness of the idea. So I was sitting at the stoplight, and the stoplight was red for, I don't know, 30, 40 seconds or something. So I got to watch that wanting. And I decided, I mean, there was a kind of a pull. Oh, I've got time. I could just drive into that Starbucks and get that latte. But I decided in that moment, and it's not to say that, you know, we never get ourselves a latte. But in this moment, I decided to simply watch the wanting. And the wanting was there. And as I turned the corner and passed the driveway of the Starbucks, it's like it got stronger. As I drove past the driveway, which I had chosen to do, the wanting disappeared. It's like the mind recognized, not going to do that. So, and the sight of the Starbucks was no longer there, kind of triggering the idea of the latte so strongly. And the energy to get to the latte was much higher in that I would have had to drive down, make a U-turn, come back, wait at another stoplight. So it was like it wasn't worth it. So there was that watching the craving, seeing what was pleasant, what was being craved, and then feeling the wanting. And feeling the wanting itself. And as I drove past that Starbucks and watched the wanting go away, there is a release there that brings a different kind of happiness than getting what we want. It's quite interesting to begin to explore this, and we start to see, actually, as we watch our minds, that moment of happiness that comes when we get something we want or when we get rid of something we don't want, the biggest piece of that happiness actually comes from the release from the wanting or the aversion, not so much from the having or the getting rid of. And so we start to see that wanting, that aversion, is optional. And when we're released from that wanting or aversion, there's a deeper kind of ease or peace in our minds. That's very different than our usual way of navigating the world. So one thing I have to say around this watching the wanting, and this kind of relates to the topic in a way of the that I am heading towards. I'll get there in a few minutes, around how do we practice without wanting to be happy. There are watching the wanting and seeing that so much of our actions are motivated by this movement of wanting to get something that we like, wanting to get rid of something that we don't like. We might wonder, and it's kind of humbling to see as we watch our minds just how much of our actions are motivated by these forces. And we might think, if I didn't want something, why would I do anything? If I didn't want to get rid of something, why would I do anything? That there's this belief in a way that this teaching around wanting an aversion and watching it and not acting on it means that we sit there like a lump on a log, that we don't take any action. And yet what happens as we engage in this practice is that we begin to see that there are other motivating forces in our hearts that are not about greed and aversion, but they're about compassion and generosity and love and wisdom. We can be motivated by compassion to alleviate suffering rather than being motivated by anger to make sure somebody gets their just desserts. So this is a shift. It's kind of a shift of our minds to understand that there are different motivating forces in the heart. And yet, as we are doing this work, you know, we have to do the best we can. You know, as we, you know, if we see some kind of injustice in the world, and this is you know, such a place of frustration and confusion and anger, when we see the racism in the world, when we see the changing climate creating conditions for animals to lose their habitat, you know, when we see war happening, it's like there's, our hearts ache with that, and we don't want it to be that way. And so while we're exploring our minds, you know, we'll see there's anger in there around the injustices in the world, and we can also recognize that anger comes from a kind of a deeper place of not wanting there to be this suffering. And that's the wholesome movement in the heart of compassion. And so as we're moving through the world, our motivations, how we're motivated, we're probably going to have mixed motivations. We are probably going to have mixed motivations as we act in the world. We are going to be angry about injustice. But there's also in our hearts the wish for the alleviation of the suffering of people who are treated in an unjust way. So can we, perhaps recognizing the anger there, also connect to the deeper wish? If we can connect to that deeper wish around compassion in our actions. Because both currents are under there. Both currents are there. And so acknowledging and recognizing the anger and seeing if maybe the action can come from a deeper connection to that wish for alleviation of suffering. In his teaching on the First Noble Truth, the Buddha encouraged us to understand dukkha, to understand this kind of suffering, to understand this reactivity. And that's what I've been talking about. Can we turn towards the reactivity with mindfulness and begin to explore it? What does it mean to be a human being that wants? What does it mean to be a human being that's angry? This is the path of practice that the Buddha suggested. Understand it. He didn't say, hate that anger. That would be adding another layer of aversion to the state of mind itself. He said, understand that reactivity. So bringing the movement of wisdom, of mindfulness, of compassion for our own suffering around that reactivity. Can we open to it? Can we meet it? Can we explore it? That is what he meant by understanding suffering. Since this suffering that we're talking about today, the kind of suffering that can be released in this very life, is related to our own mental reactivity, That's why it can be released. Because it is, you know, it's conditioned and it's deeply conditioned. You know, as I said, we know we come into this world and that's the way we're trained to find happiness. And so, you know, it's very deeply conditioned that we move towards wanting to get something that we want, wanting to get rid of something that we don't want. And so it's going to keep happening, even as we begin to recognize experientially how unhelpful it is. It keeps happening. This can be a frustrating time in practice sometimes. It's like, I've seen this over and over again. Why doesn't it stop? Why? I mean, I know that this anger isn't helpful. Why doesn't it go away? So there can be frustration around it. There can be wanting around getting rid of it. And yet this very movement of our reactivity, this is the place, I mean, it's basically pointing us to this needs to be understood. What's happening now needs to be understood. And so we can use our suffering as a guide for us. Something's happening. So, you know, it's like we check in. It's like, is this thing that's happening, you know, is it something that is, you know, is it just unpleasantness? Is it just unreliable? Or is there something extra that's being added in my own mind around that unpleasant, around that unreliable? Is there some kind of reactivity that's added? When we see that, that's a call to understand it. So that's a call to make that turning towards, what is this experience of being a human being with this reactivity? So we can use our reactivity, our suffering, as a guide for us that something is still being held. There's a piece in our mind that is holding on to something, not wanting something to be a certain way, that's not aligned with things as they are. There's sometimes maybe a kind of a new age saying that's something like, we get the lessons we need in this life. I think it's true that we'd get the lessons we need, but it's not so much about the universe figuring out what those lessons are and giving them to us. It's that we're navigating our lives and we're meeting our own minds as we navigate the world. And we're suffering when our mind clings and craves. And those are the lessons that we need to learn. How we're suffering. How we're clinging. We need to understand that. So this is the lesson that we're being asked to explore. What is this reactivity about? And perhaps in that, of course, recognizing there may be some action that needs to be taken. You know, if a suffering is happening around being in a relationship that is either physically or emotionally abusive, to stay in that relationship and say, oh, there's reactivity here. You know, that's not what this is about. There may need to be some action taken to recognize this is not a skillful environment for this being to be healthy. Can I remove myself from this environment? So this process is not just about noticing the reactivity, but recognizing when skillful action can be taken or needs to be taken. So we do get the lessons we need and we turn towards our reactivity. So when we are experiencing some kind of suffering in this way, it can be helpful to just check in. What do I want? What do I want to get rid of? Do I want to have something material? Do I want to have some kind of status? Do I want to get rid of something that I don't like? Do I want to change somebody's mind because their opinion disagrees with me? So what is it out there that I want, that I want to get rid of, that I want to fix or change? As we're experiencing sufferings, some of those things are probably going to be happening. And so we can kind of come underneath the suffering and begin to recognize that there's a relationship to something. There's something out there that I want or I want to get rid of, and my relationship to it has some kind of neediness to it. So to begin to explore that piece of it, what is that neediness? It's also often really interesting to explore, what do I believe here? What do I believe? What do I believe needs to happen? What do I believe about myself in this situation? What do I believe about other people in this situation? So some form of reflection, of using thoughts, can be helpful in this exploration of meeting suffering. So we can turn towards some reflection around what do I want? What's unpleasant in this situation? That's sometimes a really interesting thing to explore. What's either pleasant or unpleasant in this situation? Sometimes we can find ourselves in a kind of an aversive state. This happened to me the other day. Now, I don't remember what the unpleasant thing was, but I was in a kind of a general aversive state. And, oh, I remember. It was this morning. Now I remember when it was. I walked out the door, and it was like there was rain, and there was a sense of, oh, this is, so the mind was kind of a little bit grinchy, and needing to get an umbrella, and putting on all these clothes, and so there was a little bit of grinchiness, and it's, you know, within moments, the mind was like, well, what's unpleasant here? And what was really going on wasn't about the rain, but it was because I was tired. I didn't quite get enough sleep last night. So there was a feeling of tiredness. And when I landed on what was actually unpleasant, oh, this feeling of being tired. It's like all the rest of that went away. It's like, oh, this is what's actually going on. There's something unpleasant that I hadn't really noticed. So sometimes we can check into that. What's really unpleasant here? Or what do I really want? Where is this movement of pleasant and unpleasant? And, you know, to move into the topic of the, I said it was going to take me a little while to get here. as we explore this in our practice, we begin to see, you know, we begin to see a new relationship with our experience. And we begin to kind of get some release and relief around the usual reactivity that we have. And then we start to like that. We like the fact that we're not so reactive. We like the kind of calm or ease or peace that we touch into at times in our sitting or in our daily lives as we work with this exploration of meeting our experience just as it is. And then we start to want that. That's very natural. It's very natural that the mind moves towards well-being. It's very natural that the mind heads in the direction of what we understand happiness to be. And so, there will be times when we feel the suffering of that wanting some pleasant state from meditation. I mean, I'm sure most of you have experienced this, right? I mean, you're sitting in meditation. You had a good meditation yesterday. And today, the mind is kind of all over the place. And, you know, it's like, oh, I want that practice, that meditation from yesterday. I want that calm. I want that ease. I want that peace. And right there in the meditation, you're experiencing the suffering of the wanting. And the practice right there is not trying to figure out what did I do yesterday to get to that state of calm or peace, but to recognize right now there's wanting for something that's not here. That becomes the practice. And so again, you know, we use suffering as our guide. When we are suffering, we look at what we are suffering around and explore that. So there's wanting around, wanting a particular state of calm or ease or peace. What does that feel like? And an interesting teaching of the Buddha. To me, this wanting lets go in a kind of a incremental way. The craving We'll use craving because to me, craving encompasses both the desire to have things and the desire to get rid of things. So this craving, the release of the craving happens in a kind of an incremental way or in a staged way. You know, that as we begin to practice, we see that the craving around kind of more obvious things in our lives, about wanting people to have certain opinions about us or you know, kind of relationships to families, the way we're reactive there, or wanting particular status or wanting to have certain things, you know, those kinds of cravings begin to loosen somewhat. And we experience a little bit more ease or peace. In that process of letting go of the kind of more obvious forms of reactivity, a craving for calm and ease and peace in this, having a settled meditation, I would say that's a subtler kind of craving in a way. And it's a craving for something that is heading us in the direction of something that we know will be helpful. And so the interesting teaching of the Buddha that I want to point to right now, and I'll read it to you, a little piece of this. This body has originated from craving. In dependence on craving, craving is to be abandoned.
Can you say that again?
This body has originated from craving. In dependence on craving, craving is to be abandoned. Why was this said? One hears, so-and-so has realized for themselves with direct knowledge in this very life, freedom. I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not reading directly. And one thinks, when will I realize for myself this freedom? That desire or movement towards this deeper well-being, in this sutta, the Buddha points to that craving being the kind of craving that helps us overcome craving. And so, this is the beginning piece of the exploration around how do we practice without wanting to be happy? Well, we don't. That's part of what motivates us to practice. That desire, that wish, that craving for a deeper kind of happiness, a deeper freedom, is part of the motivating force, according to this sutta. And yet, what happens, in my experience, why this is the craving that helps us to overcome craving? Because we understand we're always constantly turning back, turning back, turning back. What is the experience right now? Sometimes that craving for freedom, that craving for a deeper kind of happiness, motivates us to turn towards our experience and look at aversion and look at our reactivity, look at our relationships. Sometimes that craving motivates us to engage in a non-harming way in the world, that craving for peace, for ease, for happiness. In those moments when we are kind of letting go or working with a kind of grosser form of craving, the craving towards freedom, I would say, is often not experienced as the same kind of dukkha. In fact, it's motivating us to let go and to explore kind of more obvious kinds of suffering. So this staged kind of fashion, we can let go of more obvious kinds of suffering by maybe holding on to something that's, maybe we end up holding on to the Eightfold Path, or we end up holding on to mindfulness practice, or we end up holding on to concentration and calm. At some point in our practice, so that holding on to of these more wholesome states has helped us to let go of something more sticky. And yet at some point in our practice, the very holding to that wholesome state will be experienced as painful. Right there, that is when we start to look at that kind of craving for happiness, that kind of craving for wholesome states. And this will come and go. You know, the sitting in meditation, you know, if you're sitting there craving a state from yesterday, right there is suffering. That's when we're being asked to look at it. If we're sitting in meditation and working with aversion, the movement towards holding on to the mindfulness may be not experienced as suffering in that moment. So we use suffering as our guide. Where is the suffering? I think there's often a danger at times to feel like, you know, have the idea, I'm craving to practice, so I shouldn't practice, or I shouldn't want to practice, or I shouldn't want happiness. And that can be counterproductive. You know, use the actual experience of suffering as a guide for meeting that suffering, rather than some idea of, oh, I shouldn't be wanting to practice. Well, maybe wanting to practice is what's helping you right now. So, I did get to my topic. And I didn't have time for questions. I'm sorry about that. It's time to end. So, thank you for your attention.